From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kapler.
California has long been on the cutting edge in environmental policy. But what do Californians think of the state's attempts to address climate change? And what do Californians think is the most immediate pressing environmental challenge? We'll ask. Dean Bonner with the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California that recently published a comprehensive statewide survey on Californians' view of the environment. Californians' view of state regulation and the environment. Too much, too little, or just right?
We'll also hear from John Kappeman, the executive director of the Central Valley Health Policy Institute, and Syed Sedruddin, the executive director of the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world, and by Kaiser Permanente. Thrive from the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute. It's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Dean Bonner is an Associate Survey Director with the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California, where he co-authors the PPIC's statewide survey, which is a large-scale public opinion project designed to help provide an in-depth profile of the social, economic, and political attitudes at work in California's elections and policymaking. He's here to talk about a recent statewide survey of Californians and the environment. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, what are Californians' overall perceptions of global warming or climate change?
You know, Californians, to take a step back, looking at the environment more generally, Californians are supportive of policies that look at environmental aspects of life. Specifically looking at climate change, you know, 6 in 10 Californians think that the impacts of climate change have already begun. This is a long-stead finding that we've had since 2010. And, you know, we find that majorities of Democrats and independents, as well as those across regions and demographic groups, actually hold this view. The kind of one exception, would be that Republicans are almost as likely to say that the effects have already begun as they are to say that they will never happen. And so that kind of is one thing that really stands out.
So there's a big split there within the Republican Party.
Yes.
So how serious of a threat do these folks see climate change?
You know, about half say that climate change is a very serious threat to the economic vitality and future of California. And so this is something that people view as real. Once again, I may sound like a broken record here today, but there is this partisan divide that is on a lot of these issues. But also we do find regional differences with those in, say, the San Francisco Bay Area more likely to say that it's a very serious threat, while those in the Central Valley and Orange San Diego are less likely to hold this view.
And that's kind of tainted probably by the politics, too, San Francisco probably being more Democratic, the Valley being more Republican.
Yes, definitely.
Do voters support stricter emission limits on power plants, for example, as a way to address climate change?
Yeah, so as you recall, last June, President Obama and the EPA kind of rolled out some proposals to make stricter emissions limits. And while this was a contentious issue nationally, it's not all that contentious here in California, with strong majorities saying that they favor these stricter emissions limits.
Yeah, I even saw in your report that even Republicans, 50% of Republicans support that as well.
Yes.
So let's turn to another issue that's kind of politically charged, and that's the Keystone XL pipeline. That would transport oil from the Canadian oil sands through the Midwest to Texas refineries. That's become a big political issue nationally. How do Californians feel about the Keystone XL pipeline?
As we've seen in the past, about half of characteristic of Californians are kind of divided on this issue. It's something that isn't necessarily close to home, but you do see that, you know, Democrats are much more likely than Republicans to be opposed to it, but that we do find majorities of Republicans that are actually in favor of the Keystone XL pipeline.
And what about geographically? Same kind of thing going on?
Yeah. I think you see the Inland Empire in the Central Valley is a little bit more supportive of the Keystone XL pipeline, whereas the San Francisco Bay Area and Los Angeles are a little bit less supportive.
Okay, well, yeah. So let's turn attention to another issue that's always been an issue in California, and that's offshore drilling.
Yes.
How do Californians feel about more drilling off the California coast?
Nearly 6 in 10 Californians today oppose more offshore drilling, while about 4 in 10 are in favor. This is a similar to levels that we last saw in 2010. And if we take a step back and think about 2010, what the commonality there is that in 2010 there was the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill, while today we had the, or earlier this year, there was the oil spill off of Santa Barbara. But generally speaking, outside of 2008 and 2009, majorities have opposed, less than half have been in favor of more offshore drilling. And so this is actually something that we not only divides partisans, but those, of course, who live along the coast versus who live in inland areas.
Sure. So let's talk about fracking, another big issue. That's high water pressure and chemicals used to extract oil and natural gas from underground rock formations. So not too long ago, there was talk about fracking being the next California gold rush, particularly in the valley, frankly. How do Californians feel about fracking?
You know, we find that majorities of Californians are actually opposed to fracking. Interestingly, across regions, the Inland Empire is the only place where there isn't majority opposition. And, you know, if you read a lot of news about what's going on down there, there's a decent amount of fracking occurring. And so that's something that we've seen where the Inland Empire is different. But majorities across other demographic groups are actually opposed to this, with the younger Californians even more likely than older.
What is interesting is fracking has been going on for some time, just maybe not the extent that they were talking about. But anyway, thank you for that overview of California's view on the impact of climate change on our carbon-based economy. Up next, so what do Californians think about the state's current policies to curb climate change? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Over the last several years, California has enacted several groundbreaking pieces of environmental law. Do Californians think it's been too much, too little, or just right? Our guest is Dean Bonner, the survey director for the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute. He co-authors the PPIC's statewide survey. So almost a decade later, what do Californians think of that groundbreaking piece of legislation, AB 32, passed in 2006, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to 1990 levels by 2020?
What's important when we talk about AB 32 to remember that this was passed in a bipartisan nature and actually signed into law by Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. So fast forward today, we still see that there are strong majorities who actually still favor AB 32. However, there are these big partisan differences. But that wasn't always the case. In 2006, just before the passage, we actually found that 2 in 3 Republicans, Democrats, and independents have been in favor, or were in favor. And since then, we've seen Democrats especially, but independents as well, become more supportive of AB 32, while we've seen Republicans actually have a big decrease in their support.
So the gap is getting wider.
Yes. And in fact, since 2009, fewer than 50% of Republicans have been in favor of this landmark bill.
Wow. So that's interesting. So how important do Californians think it is for the state to pass regulations and spend money to prepare for the future effects of climate change?
You know, most Californians view this as something that is important, with 6 in 10 calling it very important. In this case, once again, Democrats and independents view it as very important, while fewer Republicans view this way.
As an important thing, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, we also see that, you know, younger Californians are really viewing this is something that's very important, while older Californians are less likely to hold this view.
They're gonna have to live. There are problems. They're gonna have to live with it. But one thing I also noticed, looking back at your older surveys, you know, going back to 2013, the number's actually gone up. Who think that we should be dealing with the future effects? It was a total of 82% think it's very important or somewhat important. Now that number is 86%. So it's inching up a little bit. What about the opinions of Californians over time? I want to talk about the trend. Do they want more or less state action?
You know, Californians have kind of always been in favor of the state acting on its own outside of the federal government. Mm-hmm. And this is something that we've continuously seen here. As we've seen, the governor has really not only acting outside of the federal bounds, but also joining in with other countries to actually further climate change debate.
I think he's taking California Republic literally.
Yes. And this is something that does have very widespread support with strong majorities in most regions, demographic groups, and across parties saying that, yeah, California should act on its own outside of what the feds are doing.
Well, it's interesting. You know, there's an argument out there, of course, I'm sure you've heard it, that California can't do this alone. In fact, if it does it alone, it's going to place itself at a competitive disadvantage with other states, other countries. How do Californians feel about, you know, we being out on the cutting edge, California being out on the cutting edge and perhaps hurting us economically?
This is a huge debate when it comes to a lot of these climate change policies. In fact, just recently we did see a ballot initiative that tried to roll back aspects of AB 32.
That was unsuccessful, though.
Unsuccessful, and that is reflective of how Californians feel. Pluralities of California today, about 38%, actually say that doing things to reduce the impact of climate change will actually increase the number of jobs. Well, about one in four say it will actually result in fewer jobs, and another one in four say that it will actually not have an impact.
That's really interesting, because when you start looking at what is a green job, that becomes a debate in and of itself.
Yes.
So let me ask you about this. What about that opinion? Has that opinion changed since the Great Recession? I mean, normally when you're in a recession, people are all scrambling for jobs. When you come out of a recession, people feel a little bit more relaxed, and they say, yeah, it's okay to put a little effort or money into climate change. Do you see that in your polling?
There's been some fluctuation when it comes to the kind of the aspect of thinking that there will be more jobs or that it won't have an impact. But we found that a majority have held this view dating all the way back to the first time we asked this question in 2010, while about one in four have consistently said that there'd be fewer jobs. So it really didn't have a huge impact in reality, although the kind of discussion around it did increase a great deal when it comes to the Great Recession and coming out of it.
Maybe the intensity, too, it probably has changed a little bit with more jobs being available. Juan, I want to thank you for that overview of current state policies on climate change. So what do Californians think about some recent state proposals to address climate change? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. The last legislative session included debates on a number of important changes to environmental policy. Some passed, some didn't. So we know where the governor and the legislature are on these issues, but where is the California electorate? We're talking to Dean Bonner, the associate survey director from the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute, and he co-authors the PPIC statewide survey. So recently, the Democratic leadership pushed SB 350 that mandated several goals to be accomplished by 2030. There were three of them. One was a 50% reduction in petroleum. Second, that 50% of the state's electricity come from renewable energy. And third, that existing buildings double their energy efficiency. So what's the overall support among, or opposition among Californians for these proposals?
You know, for each of these, we found that at least 7 in 10 Californians were in favor of these proposals, with the aspects of the renewable energy as well as the building efficiency pulling higher than the reduction in petroleum use.
What's interesting on that, you know, the 50% electricity from renewables, that had a 63% support from Republicans.
Yes.
So that's so pretty high.
In actuality, you know, two of the three proposals, both the building efficiency and the renewable energies, had bipartisan support of at least half.
Yeah, it was 52% for energy efficiency. So yeah, higher numbers. But not so much on the 50% reduction. And you saw that kind of play out in the legislature, right?
Yes.
Because it didn't pass.
Yeah. Well, that, I think, along with the intense lobbying from some oil companies, potentially led to the fact that that was eventually pulled. But, you know, all three of these had strong support outside of parties, among demographic groups and across regions. And so while there was a partisan divide on all three of them, two of them were had bipartisan support, and the one that didn't ended up being
not making it.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, there was another bill that was considered by the legislature this year. That was SB 32 that would require the state to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions to 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. That didn't make it. How do Californians feel about that target?
You know, as with SB 350, SB 32 was a component of the governor's State of the State speech, where he really laid out these comprehensive climate change bills or proposals. And Californians were supportive of SB 32, and support actually very closely mirrored that of AB 32, whereas you had strong
the 2006
support. Yes. Mm-hmm. And so you had strong support across regions and demographic groups with a partisan divide, of course.
Well, and just to be clear, the 2006 law said that we were going to bring down greenhouse gas levels to 1990 levels by 2020.
Yes.
This one says we're going to go 80% below 1990 levels by 2050, just to be clear.
Yes, so as the state has, you know, been on target to reach the targets.
It looks like they're going to breach
put forth by EB 32. This would be the next step.
Right.
And Californians overall are supportive of taking this next step.
Well, let's talk about solar power. Sunshine State, I guess Florida actually can claim that, but we're going to claim it in California. What about building more solar power stations in California? Where is there support for that?
Yeah, there's support for that. There's been support overall for solar power that we found in periodic surveys over the years. And, you know, solar power is an important component of SB 350 and eventually SB 32. And so we find that, you know, strong majorities of Californians approve of or favor building more infrastructure. There is a partisan divide, but there's still majority support.
But those numbers, I think when I look in your report, those are some of the top numbers. I mean,
yes.
People seem to really want to see more solar power stations.
Yes.
The Valley is obviously an area that, you know, a lot of that could happen. Let's talk about increasing tax credits and financial incentives for rooftop solar. I think a lot of our viewers and listeners are wondering, am I going to put solar on my house? And are thinking about those incentives. Do they have a high level of support?
They do have a high level of support. It's slightly lower than what we saw for the actual infrastructure aspects of solar power, but you still have strong majorities across parties and more than 6 in 10 across regions and demographic groups actually saying that they support this. Interestingly, homeowners who would benefit from these and renters have similarly high support for this.
Yeah, maybe renters think their rent's going to go down or not go up as much if they have solar or something, if their landlord has solar. It's interesting, though, that building solar power stations has the most support.
Yeah.
And the next is infrastructure, and then the next is tax incentives for rooftop on residential. All of them, though, have, you know, we're talking 80 to 90%
yes.
support, so pretty high. Let's talk about electric vehicles. Do Californians increase supporting tax credits and financial incentives for purchasing electric vehicles?
They do. I mean, this area where California has done some work in the past, and this area where we find, you know, strong majorities are actually in favor of this. There is somewhat of a partisan divide, but we do find that, you know, there are majorities who favor this across parties, regions, and demographic groups.
Not surprising that I think your poll said highest in San Francisco, lowest in the Valley.
Because yes.
Probably people in the Valley don't think they're really
yes.
going to be getting electric cars, and San Francisco
yeah.
they do.
And there's actually a big difference between people who actually say they've considered buying an electric car with, like, I think above 8 and 10 actually in favor of these incentives and tax breaks.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm thinking, are we going to see someday people having solar on their house with electric cars, you know, having their car being charged by their roof? I guess we'll see. Well, thank
yes.
you for that overview on what Californians think of some of the recent climate change proposals. Up next, what about the most important environmental issue? That may surprise you, or it may not. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. While the long-term focus on climate change has been on reducing greenhouse gases, the most immediate and pressing environmental concern in the minds of most Californians is actually the drought. We're talking to Dean Bonner, the co-author of the nonpartisan PPIC statewide survey. So how big a problem is the drought in the minds of Californians?
You know, water and the drought just very much overshadowed any other issue when it came to the most important environmental issue in our July survey. Nearly 6 in 10 Californians said that water and the drought was the most important environmental issue. The next closest was 9%.
Wow.
That's a 50-point increase from 2011.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that.
And nearly a 25-point increase from the previous year. And that extends to when you just ask people, what's the most important issue facing people in California? It rose from an issue which was hardly mentioned when it came to the most important issue facing people in California to the last 2 months being the most important issue, topping jobs in the economy, which had been the number one issue for
right.
a long time.
Because of the recession. But it's interesting. What was a politician once said, never let a crisis go to waste. And democracy is typically reactive. And so it reacts to a problem. It's typically
yeah.
not so very proactive. It's reactive. And so I'm thinking, given these numbers for the drought, you may see water legislation on the forefront with the legislature in the coming year or so.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. So what about the impact of climate change on making the drought more severe? Do Californians believe that?
Californians definitely see the connection of not only, you know, overall climate change leading to more droughts to more severe droughts, but also kind of this particular drought. In particular, we find that, you know, there are majorities who connect climate change to droughts that are more severe. Especially of note is the fact that you know, those in the Central Valley are the least likely to say that the impacts of global warming have already begun, but the most likely to say that climate change could lead to droughts that are more severe. So there appears to be at least a little bit of a disconnect there.
Maybe it's a wait-and-see attitude, but, you know, it just seems to be a disconnect. It's important, but it's not. Well, so we're in the fourth year of a drought. Do they think the climate change has contributed to the current drought?
Yes. 6 in 10 say that climate change has actually contributed to the current drought. This is widely held across, you know, parties and regions and demographic groups. If younger people are more likely, and, you know, but those in the Central Valley aren't as likely to connect climate change to this specific drought, which is kind of interesting as well.
Right. But Republicans and Democrats still kind of split on this issue too, don't they?
Yes. You know, Democrats definitely see a connection, whereas Republicans are less likely to kind of to connect those dots. But we do, I mean, this is consistent with other issues outside of water and when it relates to climate change.
So do you think, well, do Californians think that we're doing enough to respond to the current drought, that people in their area are doing enough? When they look at their neighbors, they're saying they're doing enough to take care of the drought situation?
This has been interesting. As you know, in earlier this year, there was some statewide reductions put in place. And, you know, earlier in the year, about 2 in 3 Californians said that not enough was being done by people in their area. Well, that number has actually decreased all the way down to 48%. While at the same time, the people who actually say that the right amount has been done has actually increased 19 or 17 points since March. So there's this realization, okay, so people are doing at least something. And this meshes very well with the fact that the early numbers after the 25% reduction was put in place, we've met the target in not only June and July, but also recently it's been announced that we've met the target in September, in August as well. And so our polling kind of meshes with the reality of what's happening, it seems.
I think a lot of people drive, you know, in their own neighborhoods, they're seeing people take out lawns or not water their lawns. I mean, you know, brown is the new green, in a way. But people feel basically the 25% reduction that the governor mandated was appropriate?
Yeah, you know, about half say that it was the right amount. And this is really important because, you know, if the number were to be perceived as too much, I think that would have potentially impacted how people respond to it. Right. But we've seen a good response. We've seen majorities across regions actually say that it's the right amount. I think when it comes to this target, it's important that, you know, these targets were based from the ground up, from local water agencies up. And I think overall at the state level, people say that, you know, Governor Brown and the Water Resources Control Board actually did a good job in setting this
target.
Do most
Californians know what their targets are, do you think?
Not a whole lot. About 3 in 10 Californians actually, when asked, actually said, yeah, I know what my local water agency target is. Because it's important to remember, the 25% is a statewide number.
Right.
And that ranges from you know, I think as low as, you know, 10% all the way up to closer to 35 or so.
Right. There are a number of communities in the valley that are around 35%.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry. I interrupted.
Yeah. And so that's something that I think, you know, interestingly or notably, you know, the people who actually pay the water bills, homeowners, right, they actually are more likely than renters to actually say that they know the actual dollar or the percentage amount. And that's because most renters don't actually receive a water bill.
But your spouse will show you the water bill for sure. Well, I want to thank Dean Bonner, the Associate Survey Director for the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute, for joining us. If you want to stay current with state and local politics, but you can follow the Maddie Institute on Facebook, Twitter, or by logging onto our website at maddieinstitute.org. This is Mark Kepler for the Maddie Report. Thanks for joining us.
The views expressed in the Maddie Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Maddie Report, visit our website at maddieinstitute.org. Up next, what impact, if any, will climate change have on the Valley's economy and health? We'll talk to Syed Sedruddin, the Executive Director of the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District, and John Kappenman, the Executive Director of the Central Valley Health Policy Institute.
You're listening to the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, on KMJ.
So what impact, if any, will climate change have on the health of the Valley's economy and citizens? We have two experts to help answer that question and others. Syed Sedrin is the executive director of the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District. Welcome, Syed.
Good morning, Mark. Thank you for having us.
Great to have you. And John Kappenman, who is the executive director of the Central Valley Health Policy Institute. Welcome, Professor Kappenman.
Thanks a lot, Mark. It's great to be here.
Good. So, Syed, let me start with you. According to a paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, exceedingly high summer temperatures and longer summers are going to be driven by climate change and are probably going to be the norm going forward. What impact will hotter temperatures have on the Valley's air pollution problem? Is it going to make it worse?
Of course, if you look at the dynamics that lead to formation of ozone, high temperatures are a key component of ozone formation. You basically need the pollutants, nitrogen oxides, volatile organic compounds. You need high temperatures, and also you need sunshine. High temperatures by itself may not be adequate. You to get the photochemical reaction going, you also need sunshine. So if you do get higher temperatures, ozone formation will go up. However, we have not seen that yet in San Joaquin Valley. You know, in the context of climate change, you know, a degree or two rise in average temperature is a major impact as they see it in that context. But for ozone, when we look at valley peak temperatures routinely exceeding, you know, 100 plus, we have not seen a major change in that regard. In fact, we're coming off this summer of having our cleanest ozone year on record. So the work that has been done to reduce one of the other key ingredients, the pollutants, has definitely paid off. But in terms of temperatures, we have not seen a dramatic rise in the peak temperatures that lead to formation of ozone. But that's something that we need to be careful and look at. And if that happens, we will need to have other measures to combat the sure. ozone problem.
So let me ask you this. It was kind of interesting. We were going over the statewide PPIC survey on climate change and the different perceptions in the state as to whether climate change is a serious threat. But I found one result in the survey to be kind of curious, and that was the one that said that despite being the least likely to say effects of climate change have begun, Valley residents are the most likely to say that they are very concerned about the impact that climate change is having on the drought. So I'm just wondering, why the disconnect? Can you square that circle for me, Syed?
Of course, you know, the Valley has been more dramatically impacted by drought than any other region in the state. So when you talk about drought, that is something that the Valley residents, both in the context of agricultural need for water, having a lot of communities throughout the valley not having drinking water. When you look at drought, that is a major concern. And then when you hear bits and pieces about people blaming climate change as a cause for drought, that adds to that concern, and they're more susceptible to that concern, even though they may question the climate change issues on its own to begin with. We have to be careful, those of us who care about the environment, who care about climate change, we have to be careful to make sure we don't lose credibility by trying to blame everything from drought to wildfires on climate change. There are, you know, of course, there are significant science that points to climate change. People may disagree on what is the cause, what we can do about it, but we need to be careful not to, without having a lot of credible science and evidence, try to blame everything on climate change. In fact, if you look at the science in this case relating to drought, there is more science that indicates that if we did have warming due to climate change in the Pacific Ocean, that actually leads to more water, more rain in this area. And of course, that's not what we had. So the science is mixed on, you know, whether climate change was the cause of drought or not. But we have to be careful not to lose credibility by blaming everything on climate change without having credible evidence.
Yeah, I don't know if everybody's blaming everything on climate change. Their question is whether or not it's a factor in some of these things. But let me ask you, you mentioned wildfires. You know, whether or not climate change has contributed to that problem or not, what is the impact of more wildfires on air pollution in the valley?
Well, that is a huge impact. In fact, next week in November, we are taking an item to the governing board, which, by the way, Dr. Kappenman is also a board member on the Air District, and I look to leadership and a lot of advice from him on this issue and other issues that the Air District deals with. But climate, the wildfires, they undo everything that we've done to reduce air pollution in San Joaquin Valley. To me, that is the greatest cause of public health impact to Valley residents that totally overwhelms everything that we've done, and pollution from other sources. For instance, this rough fire that we've been talking about that we had, on a daily basis, it emits 20 times more air pollution than all industrial and mobile sources combined. So,
I want to make sure I understand this correctly. You're saying that wildfires contribute more to air quality or pollution in the valley than diesel?
Absolutely. When they happen, of course, they're not routine and not throughout the entire year. But when we have these wildfires, the amount of pollution that they put into the air, for instance, just particulate matter, if you just look at particulate matter alone, that rough fire emits 100 times more pollution into the air than all cars, all trucks, all industrial sources, all farms combined in San Joaquin Valley. So the amount of pollution is great, but we have to also look at the weather conditions that does that pollution roll down the hill to the valley or not. Sometimes we're fortunate that it doesn't come our way, but when it does, you see it in the form of ash on your car, smelling the smoke. We have to cancel games. It's huge. It totally overwhelms everything else in San Joaquin Valley when those wildfires happen.
Yeah, I just want to that's a very good point, and I want to make sure we understand that we're talking about discrete events. When we're talking about the entire year, pollution from diesel is, I would think, a greater impact over the course of a year than wildfires. When wildfires occur, they are a greater impact during those days when it's happening. But let me ask you, Dr. Kappenman, this. It's pretty easy probably to understand the relationship between air pollution and health, but the connection between greenhouse gas emissions, climate change, and health is a little more difficult to kind of connect those dots, I think, for folks. Does the valley's poor air quality, does it continue to pose a serious health risk, or has it just become kind of a nuisance?
Air quality in the valley, Mark, continues to be a severe challenge. Recent data continues to show that young children are particularly vulnerable. Days with particularly high levels of particulate matter in the air are associated with spikes in asthma hospitalization. Children who live in neighborhoods with high exposure to diesel particulate are particularly greater risk for avoidable hospitalization. The health of elders has also been linked to air pollution in our region. Our work suggests that the annual costs of excess emergency room and hospitalization for low-income children linked to pollution may be on the order of $39 million. The best available science suggests that not only sickness and hospitalization, but also premature death, particularly among chronically ill elders, are higher in communities with more particulate matter and ozone pollution. Unless we can ensure that all Valley residents live in communities that meet national ambient air quality standards, will continue to experience elevated rates of illness and death, and our communities will continue to bear potentially avoidable health care costs.
Yeah, I was reading something from the California Air Resources Board that they were indicating that about 1,300 deaths occur in the valley every year that are linked to cardiopulmonary illnesses related to air quality issues. Syed, let me ask you this. The Air District, though, has a number of programs in place to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions or the carbon footprint in the valley, like policies that are intended to reduce the number of miles driven in the valley or reduce emissions from farm equipment and processes, those kinds of things. Can you tell us about some of your programs?
Yes, we have a number of programs that not only reduce the criteria pollutants, the so-called criteria pollutants that lead to the formation of ozone and particulate, but they also provide the co-benefit of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. At the Air District, our top priority, of course, is to attain the health-based standards for ozone and particulate that are causing immediate public health impact right now as we speak. But we understand that there are a lot of resources at the state level aimed at reducing greenhouse gas measures, and we've been working actively to find measures that not only reduce nitrogen oxides, particulate matter, but also reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We have a number of programs in place through the incentive programs where we actually pay businesses and other entities to find alternative clean fuels, go to zero emission vehicles, cleaner trucks, cleaner cars, charging stations, repairing people's vehicles in our tune and tune-up programs. Everything that we do that reduces combustion emissions obviously also reduces the greenhouse gas emissions. And these also include the other things that lead to reduction in the so-called short-lived pollutants, such as black carbon. For instance, when you reduce diesel combustion, you are eliminating black carbon. When you reduce fireplace emissions, which is a big program, last year we invested $7 million in buying Valley residents cleaner wood stoves and cleaner heating devices, on natural gas even. And all of those programs that reduce the so-called short-lived greenhouse gases. And by short-lived, I mean, you know, they only last about 100 years, still a long time, but compared to other pollutants, they're considered short-lived. All of these programs are in direct source review rule, which requires developers to build more pedestrian-friendly development, reduce vehicle miles traveled. All of those measures not only reduce greenhouse gases, but they will also help us with our critical mission, which is reducing ozone and particulate matter.
Yeah, you know, Dr. Capman, I kind of want to kind of touch on something that Syed was talking about, and that was, you know, fireplaces. You know, during the winter, people like to use their fireplaces. I think people assume that one type of pollution is the same as any other type of pollution. I mean, is that true? Does fireplace smoke kind of pose its own unique risks?
Absolutely. You know, the Air District has for several years implemented policies to reduce wood burning and encourage people to convert wood stoves to natural gas, or if they really want to burn wood, to new EPA-certified stoves. If you burn an open hearth or an older wood stove, it's like smoking packs and packs of cigarettes in your home and not giving it a chance to air out. The burning wood creates very small particulate matter that lodges in your throat and lungs, and some of the components of wood smoke are known to be cancer-causing. Burning open fireplaces and older stoves also exposes your neighbors to high levels of harmful junk in the air. While the new EPA stoves have been shown to reduce this kind of exposure considerably, burning wood still creates more pollution in your home than other kinds of heat. We really hope that the new incentive programs developed by the Air District will encourage people to convert those older wood burning stoves to the cleaner natural gas stoves or to the EPA certified stoves.
You know, it's interesting. When I moved here about 20 years ago from the East Coast, I noticed that in the winter that you could smell smoke in the neighborhood. I thought, oh, isn't that nice? It's like you're at a campfire. And then after about 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 days of that, it's like enough already, because the smoke seems to hang here with the fog. It just seems to hang in the valley. So that's, I guess, pretty problematic. But, Syed, let me ask you, you know, the EPA recently awarded the Air District nearly $6 million to fund changing wood-burning devices and also replace farm tractors. I'm just wondering who is eligible for those programs and how do people apply for that money?
Yes, that's something that we are quite grateful for, the contribution by the federal government to help us work on, you know, the critical problems that we face in the valley. As far as the tractors go, the farmers that are eligible for that are the ones that have the so-called oldest Tier 0 tractors that emit about 90% more than these newer ones that we are willing to help.
When you say Tier 0, what does that mean, and what tier are we at now, and what does that mean?
Well, we'd like to move them to Tier 4, the so-called Tier 4 engines, which are the latest technology that has onboard devices for reducing particulate matter, as well as the catalytic converters and other devices, combustion devices that reduce nitrogen oxide.
So it sounds like a big jump. It seems like a big jump between Tier 0 and Tier 4.
Yeah, the emissions will be reduced by over 90%. So the older tractors emit 10 times more than these newer tractors do. As far as the fireplaces, anyone in the valley that has a conventional open hearth fireplace is eligible, or if you have an older wood stove device that now you're willing to replace it with a newer one is eligible. We pay $1,000 towards the purchase of the newer devices. If you go with natural gas, we pay an additional $500 towards the purchase of the device and also the installation costs that might be involved with natural gas. And if you're low income, instead of $1,000, you actually get $2,500 for a total of $3,000 if you go natural gas, which in most cases covers the entire cost for the low income individuals.
So kind of a win-win. You get to have your fire, but you get to do it in a clean way. Well, up next, we're going to talk a little more about the state's climate change policies and whether it's a drag on the Valley economy or does it present an opportunity. That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
You're listening to the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
Welcome back. We're talking to Syed Sedruddin, the executive director of the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District, and John Kappenman, the executive director of the Central Valley Health Policy Institute, about climate change and other related issues. So, Syed, let me start this segment with you. One argument you hear at the state level is that we really can't combat climate change alone, that to do so places California at a competitive disadvantage. You kind of hear the same argument, frankly, at the regional level, where they say these regulations limiting greenhouse gases and air pollution policies places the Valley at a competitive disadvantage for attracting businesses. And I'm thinking specifically about efforts to keep a more of the value-added side of agriculture in the Valley, things like food processing. Is there a concern that that cap and trade and those kinds of policies adversely affect the efforts to make the Valley an exporter of ag more than just an exporter of ag commodities, but both a producer and a processor of food?
You know, that is a good question, but it's a very complex question. And
that's why it was
really
so long, Syed.
And there isn't really a simple answer to it. You know, people look at it from different perspectives. If you look at the California's economy, it's been doing well, better than a number of other regions in the nation, despite having all these tough requirements that we have in place. Now, it is true that if California, at the end of the day, was the only state and the only region in the world that did climate change, even if we eliminated all greenhouse gases that are generated in California in terms of its global impact with climate change, it will be insignificant. The hope here is in California that by leading the effort, we will bring other states and other nations along and set a role model that they will follow. Now, in terms of its economic impact, again, you have to talk to economic experts because when people decide to locate here or move out of here, businesses, there are a whole host of issues and concerns that they have, and it may not be only environmental or air pollution regulations. What I can tell you factually is that in the 35 years that I've been doing this, working at the Air District, we have lost a lot of food processors. We have hardly any cotton ginning in Fresno County and in Kern County compared to what we had a few years ago. When I started back in the 80s, we had a number of so-called canneries or food processing plants. Many of them have moved out or have consolidated. We have very few. So it is hard to say whether air quality is the reason for it or not. I know the Valley continues to suffer from double-digit unemployment. We do have the toughest air regulations in the nation, in the state, at the Air District, with respect to what the farmers have to do, what the industrial sources have to do, and those are not cheap. But we work with business community effectively to find the most cost-effective way that we can get to the end result, and sometimes even achieve a greater result in terms of air pollution reduction at a lower cost. And generally, we've had a great support from the business community. So it's a difficult question, but we definitely have to keep an eye on this and make sure we do the best we can to satisfy these very tough challenges that we face with respect to air quality, but try to do it in a cost-effective fashion.
Yeah, Dr. Kappenman, let me ask you this. There's a flip side of that argument, and that is companies may be at a competitive advantage by getting cost savings with fewer employees getting sick or having health issues. And that translates to less, lost work time and lower health insurance costs. I mean, aren't there some advantages to dealing with air pollution?
You know, before transitioning back to the health impacts, I really do want to emphasize that efforts aimed at reducing our dependence on fossil fuel can stimulate economic growth. This is not the only the scientific consensus, but also the opinion of the vast majority of Californians, according to the PIPIC survey we were talking about earlier.
Right.
For example, the regulatory impact assessment for the new ozone standards nationally indicates a net economic benefit in the order of $170 to $250 billion a year. Building sustainable cities and more energy-efficient farming operations will attract new investment and create jobs. If we fully utilize emerging technologies, efforts to reduce greenhouse gases can have these important impacts. Efforts to capture more of the agricultural value chain by locating food processing and marketing efforts in the valley can be complementary with these goals. And yes, you're right, it seems very likely that reducing air pollution exposure and creating more opportunities for active transportation will have positive effects on the health and may lower employer costs. For example, findings from the Southern California Children's Health and Air Pollution Study showed that improvements in air quality were associated with reduced levels of respiratory illness, hospitalization, and by extension, reduced healthcare costs. So, yes, there really is that potential benefit.
You know, I thought I had read somewhere that that the Central Valley Health Policy Institute had a study where they're talking about the economic cost of and health complications and lost productivity associated with ozone and particulate matter. And they said, I think the study said it was something like around the range of $3 billion a year, which is the equivalent to the value of Fresno County's entire annual almond, grape, poultry, and dairy production. And that's the, those are the kinds of numbers we're talking about, aren't we?
Yep.
Yep. Very brief and to the point.
Yeah. I mean, you know, people can debate the methods of these studies, but it's very clear that the savings in lives and the savings in terms of people getting sick will have significant economic impact.
Mark, something that we have to be careful when we talk about the health impact, which is clearly significant and something that definitely needs to be in the mix when we talk about the cost or benefits of various regulations, is the fact that you know, that $3 billion or $6 billion, if, when you look at the total of particulate and ozone that we talk about, not all of those dollars are a direct infusion in or extraction from the actual economy. A big part of what went into that cost is the life insurance value, if you will, that they place on a premature life. Of course, you know, there's no value that you can put on lost lives and premature deaths, but to say that, you know, that $3 billion is something that will be infused into the economy is not really what that those studies were intended to claim.
Well, what are you saying that there's not an impact or just something less than $3 billion?
Well, there's huge impact in terms of, you know, lost productivity, health care costs. Those are real costs to the economy, obviously. But a big part of that $6 billion or the $3 billion that you're talking about was, for instance, when you take that 3,000 premature deaths, they assigned something like in the order of, I believe it was something like $7,000 per life or something like that they attach to a cost of a life.
Yeah.
So
well,
you know, whether that's an actual cost to the economy or, you know, what they see as a social cost is something that we need to be careful at.
That's a fair observation.
You know, and just to emphasize that you really can't put a value on human life.
Yeah, but
so
one thing,
3,000 extra deaths are a huge public health concern, and I think a concern for all of us as we try to create a civil society and maintain a civil society in the valley.
Yeah, it's
the
one
idea
thing
that we're losing people prematurely, unnecessarily because of environmental conditions is a huge concern. And yes, Syed is right that some of those costs represent the opportunity costs associated with the loss of a human life. But even if you don't accept the exact dollar amounts, I think that the more important point is the regulatory impact assessment findings from at the federal level about the rather significant annual benefit of achieving the new ozone standard.
And Dr. Kapitman is absolutely right. I mean, if you look at, you know, a tornado that comes through or a hurricane that comes through, and let's say, you know, 100 people lose property or life. That's a huge public concern, but somehow with air pollution, when we talk about 3,000 premature lives, it doesn't have the same impact because it's not right in your face, visible as it is in something like a hurricane. But the impact from air pollution is much more severe on public health and public property than you would see from a hurricane event that obviously makes a big news flash and gets people more concerned.
Yeah, and the long latency period, right? I mean, from exposure to illness, people don't sometimes make that connection. But I'll tell you one thing that you do see sometimes with businesses is the ability to attract people to the valley.
Absolutely.
Because some folks say, I don't want to live in a place that has those kinds of air quality issues. I don't want to expose my family to that risk. So there seem to be some business implications. I know we've had that issue when we recruited for the university of getting faculty to move here.
The concern
typically is the spouse says, I'm not sure I want to expose my kids to that air. So those are lots of big issues. And I know, Syed, we appreciate your organization working on it, as well as Dr. Katman. And we also want to thank you guys for being our guest today. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It was great.
The Matty Report. Valley Views Edition is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Matty Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.